Support for the All Sides with Ann Fisher podcast comes from Wolf's Ridge Brewing, a family-owned Columbus brewery and restaurant, offering home beer delivery and curbside food pickup Tuesday through Sunday. More at wolfsridgebrewing.com.
Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. More than 200 million people around the world suffer from incontinence, and often the shame and depression that can accompany the condition. Women are affected more than twice as often as men, which is why for years the medical community treated bladder control issues as a normal phase in a woman's life, especially after childbirth. But incontinence isn't a given, and ignoring the issue has its own costs. Besides the emotional cost, there's a financial toll, $80 billion in the U.S. as of last year. Lucy Brett is the author of a new memoir. It's titled PMSL, or How I Literally Pissed Myself Laughing and Survived the Last Taboo to Tell the Tale. Welcome, Lucy, and thanks for giving me an excuse to say that naughty word.
Thank you so much for having me. I think the book has lots of naughty words in it.
You said you were shy about your body and that it was embarrassing to discuss something so personal. So kind of take us back to that time when you suddenly realized something had gone horribly wrong.
Well, so I think that there were sort of a couple of moments. It was kind of a gradual realization when I stepped out of the labor ward room and I first saw myself, the sort of relic that was once me after I'd given birth, and I was still, you know, covered in the detritus of labor. So I had blood on me and various other fluids with best not mention. And I remember looking and thinking, what is that? And realizing it was me. And it was probably the first time as an adult I've stood in a puddle of my own pee. And then over several weeks, quite a lot of people kept saying, oh, it's a normal part of after you've had a baby. And I kept thinking, well, I'm not just weeing a little bit. This can't be normal. But it probably took a few weeks until I was finally in a doctor's office. And it was like an epiphany. The light came in through the window. And I thought, everything you've said is like from a leaflet, but it's not for me. I am broken. And when I told her again, she confirmed I was. However, at that point in life, I was still quite shy. So I've written a whole book about incontinence, but I'm someone who finds it difficult to make jokes about breaking wind and trumping. So it was a very strange thing. But I was speaking to a physiotherapist and I said to her, I didn't quite know myself what had happened. And she said, oh, I do. She said, somewhere in the journey, you forgot to be ashamed. And I was like, yes, that is what happened. So after I'd been incontinent for a number of years, there reached a point where I was listening to the sort of stats you just read out and researching it. And I was more cross and angry and fired up than I was ashamed. And the balance tipped. And I thought, I've got to talk about this. And then when I realized not many people were talking about it, and I, for whatever reason I could, I thought, well, then I have to. I just have to say it. Because nobody's saying any of it.
What ticked you off? What was the breaking point? When you were listening to those stats, you said, wait a minute, something has to be done. What was it about those statistics that, you know, pissed you off?
Well, so one thing was that research shows that incontinence is really closely linked with depression. So I was looking at how glamorous is this, how you solve what we'd call in the UK nappy rash. I don't know if you call it diaper rash or what in the States. Yeah. So if you have to wear a lot of adult pads, you can end up with urine burns and rashes. And I couldn't work out what to do about mine because all the information was for elderly people in elderly people's homes. And I was Googling what are the side effects of incontinence, and depression came up. And I thought, I had a traumatic childbirth. I had incontinence both times after both my births. I've ended up with years of physiotherapy and with surgery, and nobody has once said that my depression might be linked to it. So I just thought I was a rubbish mum and I had a rubbish body, that it was my fault. And I thought then if you combine that with it being in the UK, one in three women, the world over, it congregates around one in three, one in four women who suffers from this. If there are so many of us, why aren't we more honest about it all? Why did nobody say that to me?
It's the same thing goes for things like menopause.
Right?
Right.
That's really funny you should say that, because that's sort of, I write this book and obviously my mum is super proud and buys several copies and her friends have all read it, which is slightly weird because it's all like, I didn't realise my friends and their husbands would all read this book about my private parts. But a couple of them have said to me, if you think you're cross about that, wait for the menopause, yeah. Lucy.
Yeah. So anyways, I just want to remind listeners who are listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is the author of a new memoir. It's titled PMSL, or How I Literally Pissed Myself Laughing and Survived the Last Taboo to Tell the Tale, Lucy Brett. We're talking about incontinence in women, which women are twice as likely to suffer from incontinence, and it's largely associated with birth. But Lucy, you know, one of the things about it that is that if you don't talk about it, then you can't treat it. And if your physician treats it as if it's just something you have to live with, then how are you supposed to know?
Right. And I think this is a terrible issue. So I think that I say in the book, that, you know, it's like this myth or lie that people tell themselves that incontinence is an inevitable part of aging, an inevitable part of childbirth. And that's the other thing that kind of fired me up, was that the more I researched it, the more people I met who worked in this field. So incontinence nurses, surgeons and people like that. So not general doctors or or even obstetricians, but people who work around continence and bowel and bladder function. Mm-hmm. They all kept saying the same thing, like a mantra: incontinence is common, but it's not normal. And I was like, what?
What's the diff?
Yeah, what? You know, so actually, I was like, what about when you're old, you know? And they were saying, oh, no, it does, even with elderly women, it doesn't necessarily have to be so. And I thought, well, this is ridiculous, because then we're all spending all this money, heaven knows the cost to the environment, the cost to the economy, of women not working, marriages falling apart, all this, women being just depressed. I mean, frankly, it's bad enough if they're just feeling a bit miserable, to be honest, that, you know. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, this is just insane that it's not normal. And it can, I looked up, you know, the World Incontinence, there's all sorts of, you know, great big bodies that work with urologists and stuff. And they said it too. They said that the vast majority of urinary incontinence can be cured, and if not significantly improved in the world. I mean, so you've got a problem that is really common, that nobody talks about, that everybody believes is just something women have to put up with and shut up about, like mansplaining and, you know, political incompetence and all the other things women cope with in the menopause. And like, I was just like,
It's linked to depression,
issue,
but, you know, and on top of all of that, it's linked to depression and nobody bothers to tell you.
Right. And I mean, and also that has really terrible consequences that go beyond my own outrage and everything. So in the UK, for example, it's so I don't know the stats for America, but in the UK, it's a really common reason for elderly women to fall over because they're running to the toilet. And if you fall when you're over 80 or so in the UK, when you're older, much older, mm-hmm. you're more likely to end up in hospital. And right. once you're more like you're in hospital, when you're a geriatric patient, you're more likely to die. Mm-hmm. So if you think about your average American woman, I don't know what she'd be called, Amy or whatever, and Amy in her 20s has her first baby, doesn't realise that she should do her pelvic floor exercises. No one's explained her Kegels, so she's doing them wrong. And then she leaks a bit and she doesn't go on the trampoline. So Amy puts on weight because she can't run because she wets herself. And then as she gets older, she loses her job in a call centre because she has to keep going to the toilet all the time. And she continues to put on weight. She's quite miserable and she hits the menopause and then it gets even worse.
And it's really bad.
So by the time Amy's 70 or 80, she falls over and breaks her hip and then she's more likely to die. And you think, this is a feminist issue.
Yeah.
I mean, it's terrible. And if it's that common, we can find a language for it. We can find a way. That's what the challenge I set myself really in this book was, to write a beautiful book, a moving book, a funny book about this subject that was serious but also funny and also rude and all the and angry and all the things I was, and to remind people that there's a real person behind this. Because if it's so common and we know it's awful, mm-hmm. nobody wants to be the one who's wet themselves on the bus, none of us would want that, then why aren't we kinder about it?
You know,
we've got bodies, you know.
Yeah, well, you mentioned probably one of the most prosaic ways to address it, and that's the Kegel exercises. There's a muscle in there that we can work on.
Right. And it turns out quite a lot of people aren't necessarily getting that right. But also, there's a bigger point, which is that your pelvic floor is one, group of muscles.
Right.
But you have to exercise everything. But if your pelvic floor isn't working, it's really hard to exercise. And in the UK, there's an obesity crisis. And it's like, well, why aren't we addressing the fact that many women is a barrier to exercise? And so we need to teach people how to do their pelvic floors. Now, in the UK, I don't know about in the States, but in the UK, when that really hits home is when you're about 8 months pregnant. Mm-hmm. And I have to confess, I mean, I wish this wasn't the case, but, I was kind of powered down to amber by then. It was like, there's only one way this is going to end. So it's like when I was giving birth and the midwife asked me if I wanted a mirror, just as my son was crowning.
Nope.
So, and I thought, the time for this is past, right?
Hello, like, no.
I mean, that should have been.
Thank her for asking first.
Well, yeah. And I said, it was funny though, but when I was writing the book and I got some medical people to read it, of course, to make sure I wasn't just making stuff up. And she said it was a really good point, because I said the problem I had was, because I'd never really looked at it in any detail, I couldn't tell what was broken. And in all seriousness, the sort of learning journey of having gone from it being very theoretical, having a baby, seeing all these diagrams and these drawings and even photographs and films and TV and all that stuff, but I still didn't really connect that with my other bits of my body that were very close by. I had no idea what friendly fire could damage could be in childbirth. And it was like, oh my God, my bottom and my urethra have become collateral damage in a way that I wasn't
expecting. I'm sorry
expecting.
To laugh.
No, it is funny though. But this is the thing. It's like, again, it sounds ridiculous, but
no, it's not.
I think I say in the book, like your pelvic floor muscles, right? I understood that they were there, and I understand that muscles would be holding all, your guts and everything inside you, or otherwise it would all fall out. But in my case, I discovered to my horror that they were kind of holding my life together. Because, if you can't cross the road and push your baby in its, I don't know what you call it in America, in its pram, I'd say, up the curb, if you can't do that without wetting yourself, that is very isolating.
And by
terrifying.
The time your kid's in his, 5 or 6 are up and you want to jump on the tramp with them, hello.
Right? You can't. And also by then problems might be more entrenched. The silence thing, because people don't talk about it enough, or they just sort of say, I might have a little accident. And so women think, it's normal, I won't get any help. And the longer you leave it, possibly things get more entrenched and harder to solve. The only weird, unnormal thing about my story, I think, in lots of ways, is the fact that I got help early, whereas the average is about 7 years over here for women to start wetting themselves and then go to the doctors. And I went quite quickly because the good thing was my problem was so bad you couldn't ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas for a lot of women, it's like, don't drink too much.
Right. Or just don't go for long walks or don't exercise or whatever. I mean, just
know
avoid
where the loo is.
All
go
of
to
these
the loo,
things.
Just in case.
Yeah. Well, you've heard from a lot of people who have read the book talking about your personal story. And you've also heard from men. What are you hearing? What kind of feedback are you getting from people?
First of all, it's a huge honor in many ways, because people are telling me very, very personal stories, sometimes for the first time. So I've had people saying things like, they had their baby 40 years ago, and this is the first time they were able to talk about it. Or girlfriends of mine saying that their mothers have rung them up and told them this stuff that had never mentioned before. So I feel very privileged to hear it, but I am hearing from men as well. And it's quite interesting. So I wrote this book to smash the stigma around continence, but also because I think that there's an even bigger point about all conditions that are embarrassing or make us feel ashamed or vulnerable, and that we have to try and find a way of whatever it is, moving beyond it, or otherwise all the burden and all the worry ends up on the patient, and that is, it's unbearable and they shouldn't have to carry it. But I've had men contact me and say, I had one guy contact me and say that, it's going to make me cry, that he's in his late 20s and he wets the bed. He has a condition that means he wets the bed and he's never spoken to anyone about it. How isolating is that?
That's a whole nother, can of worms, right?
But another thing that can often be massively helped, if, you know, the help is out there, the evidence-based, the research, the treatments are often there. I mean, there was a time when I think incontinence, there was a group of charities in Europe that got together and said that incontinence isn't always given the sort of research funding and research interest it deserves, because for a couple of reasons, the shame and the stigma, but also because incontinence is connected to lots of things. So the menopause and childbirth, of course, but also multiple sclerosis, Alzheimer's, dementia, various breast cancer treatments and things like that. So, and if you're having breast cancer treatment, it might be that the incontinence is really affecting your quality of life, but you're not going to bring it up with your cancer doctor because it's not at the top of the list. So there's a sort of top of the list thing. Yeah. People don't think they can bring up incontinence because it's too trivial, even though all the research shows that it's massively linked to poor quality of life and depression. So it's kind of a double bind.
Well, Lucy Brett, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today about this and opening, trashing the taboo in your book. And I wish you all good things and hope that folks will check out your book for sure.
Thank you so much for having me. And thank you for letting me smash the stigma on your show, because the more people talk, the better things will get.
You got it. Lucy Brett, she's author of a new book. It's a memoir. It's titled PMSL, or How I Literally Pissed Myself Laughing and Survived the Last Taboo to Tell the Tale. We have more. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. And we have more Wellness Wednesday coming up. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for the All Sides with Ann Fisher podcast comes from Wolf's Ridge Brewing, a family-owned Columbus brewery and restaurant, offering home beer delivery and curbside food pickup Tuesday through Sunday. More at wolfsridgebrewing.com.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Baseball legend Lou Gehrig in 1939 delivered his famous farewell address to a sold-out crowd at Yankee Stadium after receiving his terminal diagnosis of amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS. And he called it kind of like just his bad luck.
For the past 2 weeks, you've been reading about a bad break. Today, I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth.
He called it a bad break, but Gehrig made the disease famous. 75 years later, the Ice Bucket Challenge of 2014 did the same when it became a global internet sensation, raising about $220 million for ALS research. Now a clinical trial supported by revenue from the challenge shows promise in slowing the onset of ALS. Dr. Adam Quick is a neurologist at The Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center, where he cares for patients in the ALS clinic. Welcome to the show, Dr. Quick.
Hello, it's great to be here.
So what is ALS?
So ALS is what we call a neurodegenerative disease, which is a big word. But basically what it is it's a disease of the nervous system where neurons in the nervous system or nerve cells in the nervous system that are important for controlling our movement, both in the brain and in the spinal cord, start to become dysfunctional. And those motor neurons start to die off. And as a consequence, our muscles get weaker because we're not able to send the signal of what we want to do when we want to move from our brains out through the nervous system to our muscles. And that's kind of the basic idea of what ALS is.
Muscles weaken for lack of use.
Well, it's not because of a lack of use
per
se. It's actually because the nerve going to the muscle isn't working. So I think an analogy would be like if you had a phone and the wire to the phone was cut. So the phone itself might be perfectly fine, the phone representing the muscle, but basically the signal isn't getting to the phone, and so the muscle becomes dysfunctional and weak.
So it becomes dysfunctional, but it's a neurodegenerative, and that suggests that there's a continuum in this process. It doesn't all of a sudden one day you don't wake up without being able to move.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So ALS is a disease that often begins very insidiously, and frequently it can be confused for other things because it really happens differently in every person who gets it. So in one person, their very first symptoms might be weakness in a hand. In another person, their first symptoms might be weakness in a foot or a leg. But basically what happens is after that weakness begins, inevitably as the disease progresses, the weakness gets worse in the area that it started, and then it starts to progress to involve other areas of the body.
Does it matter where it starts? Does that tell you anything?
It matters to some degree. There is some research that shows that if muscles in the head and neck area are affected first, or certainly if muscles of breathing are affected first, that people with those problems oftentimes have a worse prognosis. So it does matter from that perspective, but inevitably for people who have ALS, usually the weakness sort of begins in one area and then kind of spreads to involve most of the rest of the body over time.
Famed astrophysicist Stephen Hawking had ALS. He died in 2018. He lived with the disease for 55 years. Was that unusual, or is it becoming more normal, or where does he fall on that?
Sure. That's extremely unusual. And so, you know, he represents a significant outlier for what is normal with the disease. And I will say that, you know, part of what allowed him to live so long was that he had excellent medical care. So he used mechanical ventilation to help him breathe. And that's why we saw pictures of him, you know, later in life in a wheelchair with all these kind of machines and things hooked up to him. And people with ALS can live for a long time. Typically what causes people with ALS to eventually die from the disease is difficulty with breathing function, so respiratory muscle weakness. So if people choose to go on a mechanical ventilator and have their breathing work done for them by the ventilator, they can actually live for a long time. It's just that here in the United States, a lot of people don't choose to do that because even if you do decide to go that route and do mechanical ventilation, the disease continues to progress and your muscles still continue to get weak. So
there's no cure. Are they still looking for a cure, number one? And is the big challenge nowadays to slow the spread?
Right. So there is no cure for ALS. And certainly we're working towards that. And we would love for there to be a cure one day. Right now, really what the bulk of the research out there is doing is looking at things that we believe will slow down the progression of ALS. So kind of slow it down so that it affects people over a much slower and longer period of time, and ideally even find therapies that might target processes in the nerve cells that are dying off to stop those processes and maybe even arrest the disease. So it would be great, I think, one day if we could sort of catch people early on in the illness and maybe provide them a medication or a combination of medications that sort of halt the process. But that's really where things are at this point in time.
How is the illness ultimately diagnosed? Is there how do you know?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it can be a challenge to diagnose because it does start differently in everybody.
Yeah.
As I said before, in one person it might start with weakness in the hand, another person it might start with weakness in a leg. And so it can be kind of confusing, but the hallmark of ALS is really weakness, you know, weakness of a muscle that typically starts in one part of the body, gets worse over time, starts to spread to involve other parts of the body. And then when we see that in somebody that we're seeing in our clinic, we always become very concerned about that diagnosis. And really the way ALS is diagnosed for most people is by seeing their doctor, oftentimes getting referred to see a neurologist. And it, you know, many neurologists have a lot of familiarity with this disease. It's not, you know, simply people who are experts at specialized centers. But seeing a neurologist and getting checked out and having a good neurological examination and talking with somebody about the symptoms they're having. And ultimately, that's really how you make the diagnosis.
So there's not like a test, a blood draw that does it?
No, there really isn't. It's
okay.
One of those diseases in medicine where we don't have an MRI scan or a blood test or anything that makes the diagnosis. It's really what we call a clinical diagnosis,
Okay. Which
really means it's all about what are the signs and symptoms that somebody has and what do you see when you examine them.
So a pair of Brown University College students came up with a new treatment, and I'm just wondering, how did it the idea go from, you know, a dorm room brainstorm, is the way I'm being told, to a clinical trial?
That's a great question. And it is true that, yeah, this was thought up and devised by a couple of college students at Brown, which is kind of amazing. And honestly, I don't know the details of their entire story, but they were students who were studying and sort of thinking about diseases like ALS that are these neurodegenerative diseases. And they're trying to think of ways to affect those diseases with the processes that were going wrong in the brain cells, in the neurons that were dying off in these. And so they contacted some people. I think they made some contact with somebody at Mass General Hospital, and they had this idea of combining these two medications or these two compounds that both had a different mechanism of action. And they thought, well, maybe if we combine these things together that both work differently and affect different pathways in these motor neurons, that would have a better effect than, say, one drug by itself. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they worked with people at Mass General Hospital, and over a period of several years, they found that these compounds actually did help motor neurons live. This is outside of people sort of in the lab. And they did some safety studies. And then ultimately, it was put together as a clinical trial through the Northeast ALS Consortium, which is a group of ALS centers around the country and internationally. And OSU is a member of that. And we got to participate in this study by virtue of being part of that larger consortium.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with OSU neurologist Dr. Adam Quick about what we're talking about, which is a new treatment for ALS. It's a combination drug. Dr. Quick, what was the study like? How did it work?
Yeah, so what we did, and when I say we, I really mean our team here at Ohio State and other ALS teams across the country. We were one of just 25 sites in the United States that participated in this study. But what we did is we talked with our patients in our clinic who had ALS and explained to them what the study was looking at. And really what the study was designed to do was to see if this medication or this compound would slow down the progression of the disease. And so for people who were interested in participating, you know, we talk to them about it, and they come in to our center, and we provide them with the medication, and then we follow them over a period of about 6 months' time. And we basically watched how the disease progressed in those people. And there was a placebo group, which was compared to the treatment group. And then at the end of that period of 6 months, the data from all the centers that were participating in this study were analyzed. And what we determined was that the people who got the treatment actually had a slower rate in their ALS progression than the people who got the placebo.
You know, you said that it's hard to diagnose because it starts in all different ways in different kinds of people. And I asked you if where it starts suggests anything. And you made the point that, well, if it starts in, you know, the lungs or something like that, the muscles around those, then that does not bode well because you need your lungs to breathe. When it came to the groups that you tested, were you looking for similar starting points?
Yeah, so everybody who enrolls in a clinical trial, almost any clinical trial in medicine, you're trying to get people into the study, into the trial that have kind of similar features in terms of the way they look. And so this trial enrolled people who had a sort of a research definition of what we call definite ALS. And that's not necessarily important for your listeners, I think, to understand, but it is sort of one of the things that qualified people to be able to be part of this study. And so in order to have definite ALS, there's certain criteria that you sort of have to meet. You have to have weakness in, you know, in 3 out of 4 body parts. And,
okay.
And like I said, that's not so important, but that was really the design of the study was to enroll people in it who had that clinical definition.
And it's dubbed AMX0035, and it's a combination drug. Is it unusual to do when it becomes a combination drug, how do they take it? Is it injected in them? Is it a pill?
No, actually, it's just a powder. So it's a powder that you can dissolve in water or any other liquid, and then you drink it. So it's really very easy to take. And for the most part, people who are in the study you know, did really well with it. There was a few, you know, stomach side effects, but very few serious side effects. And it was actually a really well-tolerated medication.
And then after you determined in the trial that it was effective, at least by way of the trial, then what do you do with the folks that were in the placebo group?
Well, so that's a great question, and we don't actually know. So when we do research studies like this, I, you know, as the physician or my colleague Steve Kolb, who's one of the other neurologists and is actually the director of our ALS center, we don't know the people who are on the placebo versus the people who are on the medication.
It's a double blind.
Exactly. Yeah. And so what was nice about this study, though, was that everybody who participated in it, people who are both on the active medication and the people who are on the placebo, had the opportunity when the study was over to switch over to the active treatment. So they were able to start taking the AMX0035 as sort of a continuation of the trial. But the actual study had ended, but this was just and actually, this is sort of a side, but this is why being involved with research is so important, because for people who are involved with clinical trials like this, oftentimes it does allow those participants to continue taking a medication even as the results are being analyzed and before the medication can come to market.
Yeah, and what's the where is that in the process for this drug?
Yeah, so I know that the company who makes it, Amylyx, is working really hard with the FDA to try and get this approved and you know, out there to market and to the general population. And you know, I'm not part of that particular process.
Uh-huh.
I do know that that's something that they're working very hard to do, because they really feel very strongly that you know, since this showed an effect in this clinical trial, that they would really like to make it available to people as quickly as possible.
And what this does is it slows down the deterioration of the, I guess, within two different kinds of structures, because they're two different kinds of drugs?
Well, that's a good question. And it's when you're studying a combination of medications like this, when you have two things together, it's really impossible to know which one might be more effective than the other, or if the combination of the two is really synergistic, meaning sort of a 2 + 2 = 6 kind of situation where each one on its own might not be effective, but together they are.
Yeah.
So we can't really sort that out very well. But what we do know is that this combination of things really did slow down that progression of the disease. So the disease did still continue to get worse in the people who took this medication. So it did continue to progress. And that's the normal, natural thing that you see with ALS. It's just that progression was much slower. So it's kind of like putting the brakes on the disease.
And what does that suggest going forward as far as a cure or further treatments?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think that going forward, what we're going to find is that as we understand the disease better, we're going to be able to devise new therapies like this that have a very rational reason for their use. So as we understand what's going on in the nerve cells that are dying with ALS, we can target those pathways. And I mentioned Steve Kolb, who's my colleague here in the neurology department at Ohio State.
Mm-hmm.
He's actually a physician scientist, and so he has a research lab, and he's a clinical neurologist. And so his lab is actually dedicated to looking at those pathways of dysfunction in the neurons and trying to learn more about that so that we can target those pathways to have better treatments for the disease in the future.
And just before I let you go, I'm wondering, is ALS genetic? Is there any way to know who might get it?
Sure. The answer to that question is yes, sometimes.
Okay.
So we know that about 90% of the time when people get ALS, they don't have any family history, and it's thought to probably not be genetic in those circumstances. What we do think is that there may be a combination of sort of genetic susceptibility, like a person might have a few genes that makes them susceptible for getting ALS, and then there may be some environmental factors on top of that that might lead to the person getting ALS.
Mm.
But we also know that about 10% of the time, it is genetic, and people will have a family history of it. And you can actually find those genes in people who have this familial form of ALS a lot of the time. And actually, that's another part of our work here at Ohio State, and I serve, as you led into this, we have another clinician scientist, Jennifer Rogenbuck, who's a genetic counselor at Ohio State, and she's really a national leader when it comes to developing guidelines of genetic testing for people with ALS. And one of the things that's really interesting that she determined is actually if you look at people who have sporadic ALS and you test them, oftentimes they might have a gene that is the cause of the disease that they didn't know about. And even though they had no family history of the disease or anything like that.
And when you say sporadic, sporadic symptoms.
Right. No, when I say sporadic, I mean somebody who gets ALS who does not have a family history of ALS.
Gotcha. Okay.
So we differentiate sporadic ALS, meaning somebody who just gets it, from familial ALS, which is somebody who has a family history of ALS and then gets it.
Well, Dr. Adam Quick, thanks for taking the time to talk to us today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it was great to talk to you. Thank you very much.
You bet. Dr. Adam Quick, neurologist at Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center, which was participated in a trial of a new drug. It's a combination drug. It's dubbed AMX0035. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The death of 43-year-old actor Chadwick Boseman last month from colorectal cancer has attracted fresh attention to the risk of the disease in younger people. Boseman, who was diagnosed at age 39, was best known for his portrayal of superhero Black Panther and real-life icons, including baseball hero Jackie Robinson, music star James Brown, and Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall. Colorectal cancer is usually found in older people, but the number of cases in adults younger than 50 has been increasing. Dr. Daryl Gray is a gastroenterologist and deputy director of the Center for Cancer Health Equity at the Ohio State University Comprehensive Cancer Center. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
What are the symptoms of colorectal cancer?
You know, I'm so glad you asked, because the truth of the matter is most early stage colorectal cancers have no symptoms whatsoever. But people can present with things like blood in the stool or complaining of change in their stool caliber, maybe going from what they perceive to be a regular stool to something that is pencil thin, abdominal pain that's chronic in nature, or even something as simple as new bloating or lower abdominal pain. And signs such as anemia may not just be a sign of, for example, women who are menstruating, but it can be a sign of something else. And certainly as we think about blood in the stool, we can't just attribute it to hemorrhoids. We certainly should be seeking medical professional help to evaluate that. But again, I want to stress that most early stage colorectal cancers do not present with symptoms.
And so early stage, I mean, I'm thinking about when people start getting kind of regular colonoscopies, that would reveal if there's a problem, right?
Yes. So when most people get a colonoscopy, it might be for screening. And screening means looking for any abnormalities to interrupt the cycle from having a, for example, precancerous polyp all the way to detecting a cancer. And so by screening, our hope is to find, for example, very minuscule polyps that we can take out and, in essence, prevent a colorectal cancer from even happening. But if we happen to see a cancer while we're there, there's the advantage of biopsying it so that we can develop a strategy to hopefully cure it.
But most people don't start getting regular colonoscopies, and correct me if I'm wrong, until they're like 50, right?
That's exactly right. According to the United States Preventive Services Task Force, screening should start at age 50 for the general average risk population. Now, let's put an asterisk there, because we know since 2008, the American College of Gastroenterology, and then subsequently in 2017, the United States Multi-Society Task Force says, hold up, guys, let's start screening at age 45 amongst African Americans, because we know that they present younger with later stage of disease. But you're right. Most people and most of the doctors are recommending screening starting at age 50 amongst their average risk population.
Why African Americans presenting younger with
later stage of
disease?
Yeah,
with later stage of disease. Thanks.
You know, we don't fully understand that. Now, certainly there's some concern that it could be biologic in nature. However, we also know that there are other factors that contribute to that. As we think about risk factors for colorectal cancer, for example, we think about things like diet. We think about diabetes. We think about other underlying conditions that can predispose someone to having a higher risk of developing colorectal cancer. And we know that things like diabetes, things like obesity have high prevalence amongst populations such as African Americans. And so that may also contribute to why we're seeing younger individuals, particularly African Americans, presenting with later stage disease.
But then I think of Chadwick Boseman.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you talk about a perfect specimen and, you know, obviously an incredibly talented and wonderful person and much loved. And it just didn't make any sense. People were shocked.
Yes. And, you know, it took all of us by surprise, you know, and I definitely do not know the details of his personal or family medical history, but certainly I was one who was taken back by seeing a hero, you know, a superhero, someone who was very committed in the community, pass at such a young age from colorectal cancer, and particularly without the public knowledge of it. And it does speak to the fact that we need to do better about, you know, educating our community about colorectal cancer, and that particularly no one is immune to it. And so that's why it's so important that we're vigilant about establishing care with healthcare providers who know us, with whom we can talk to about symptoms or concerns, and who can help us decipher what our family history means and when we should start screening.
I mentioned earlier that colorectal cancer is showing up in increasing numbers of younger adults, and, you know, including obviously Boseman. But do we know what that's about?
You know, it's a great question. I'll tell you, a lot of time and resources are now being invested into what's considered early onset colorectal cancer, because we know traditionally we would think that this early onset is purely attributed to genetics. You have a family history, for example, of someone in your family who has a familial syndrome that has contributed to your higher disposition of getting colorectal cancer. But we're noticing that that is not the case. Similar to your prior discussion that you had with one of my OSU colleagues in neurology about ALS, there is a lot of sporadic colorectal cancer, meaning that without a known family history of colorectal cancer, young individuals are developing it. And we don't completely know why. Again, it's been thought that maybe the increase in obesity epidemic in our nation has been contributing to that, but that doesn't explain the full story. And so a lot of us physician scientists or scientists are trying to sort that out now.
Do we have a sense of how much the pandemic has affected has impacted the rate of screenings and treatments?
Absolutely. So there have been an array of articles that have been published on this. I've worked with some of my colleagues, both Dr. Rachel Osaka at Fred Hutch Cancer Center, as well as Dr. Sophie Balzora at NYU, and Dr. Fola May and Dr. Ajua Anianiyoboa in regards to this. And we have seen, particularly at the height of the pandemic, we saw a significant drop in colorectal cancer screenings that were being done in endoscopy centers across the nation, appropriately so, because we received guidance that said, hey, look, for elective procedures such as colonoscopies, for example, for screening, we have to halt on that until we can get protective measures in place for our patients and our staff. The challenge with that is that it has and is predicted to lead to significant delayed diagnoses of colorectal cancer. And so people are expected to unfortunately present again with late stage disease when they ultimately undergo their either screening colonoscopy or diagnostic colonoscopy, meaning people have had symptoms but postpone their procedure because they didn't want to come back to get their colonoscopy because they're nervous about entering hospitals at this time. And so, yes, it's had a significant impact and will continue to, is what's predicted.
For folks who are having those kinds of fears and who have never had a colonoscopy before, I can't really describe what mine was like because
you were asleep.
I was asleep, very happily so, by the way. And but can you tell us what a colonoscopy is like in the process? Like, first you have to flush yourself.
I'm so happy to. So what people can expect, usually the roughest part and what you may remember most is the prep, okay? So usually that's the day before when you have to modify your diet in some way, meaning for some people that will mean they go on a clear liquid diet all day that day, the day before their exam. And then usually in the late afternoon, evening, they'll start a drink or some sort of liquid medicine that will help to flush out the bowel of any stool. Because the purpose of the colonoscopy is to be able to detect any subtle abnormality. And if you have stool in there, well, it may cover it up. And so after you've done your bowel prep, you have a companion that brings you into an endoscopy center where you're welcomed by nurses and technician staff and your doctor who will be doing the procedure. And that person will explain again the procedure to you, what you can expect, the risks as well. And then you're taken to a room where the procedure will be performed, and you're given medicine that makes you sleepy. Yes, you are comfortable and sleepy during this exam. And most people wake up wondering, did you even start yet?
Right. How long does it usually take?
It depends on what we find or what we don't find. It can range anywhere from about 15 minutes to maybe 30 minutes. And in some cases, I've had procedures that went close to an hour because people had literally 20 to 30 to 40 or so polyps that had to be removed during the exam. So it can vary.
And typically when you come across a polyp, do you just automatically remove it?
Yes.
Okay.
Most polyps can be removed. Now, there are some that are very large or maybe concerning for cancer. And so an endoscopist, a person like me performing the procedure, may choose not to remove such a large polyp or something that's concerning for cancer, uh-huh, and instead biopsy it because
What's
that may
difference?
Require a different treatment modality.
What's the difference between a biopsy and removing it during a colonoscopy?
Oh, great question. So a biopsy means taking a small piece of tissue from something that you see. Whereas removing it, I can use a device called a snare, which is almost like a lasso you might put around a horse, for example, or a very tiny version of that, to snip it right off.
And why don't you just do that instead of a biopsy when cancer is suspected?
Oh, sometimes when cancer is suspected, number one, it may be too large to remove endoscopically.
Okay.
I may not have the tools to be able to remove that whole mass.
Okay.
The other thing is, we don't know how far down or if that mass has traversed the colon, meaning extended beyond the wall of the colon into other tissues such as the lymph nodes or even spread elsewhere. And so it may not be safe to try to remove a large mass.
Because you release cells and that kind of a thing.
Right.
Okay. And all right. So somebody gets a colon cancer screening and there's a suspicious polyp, or you send it away to the, is it a pathologist? Or,
that's exactly right.
Just making this stuff up as I go along.
No, you got it. You're expert.
And so you send it to them and then they say, what are they looking for? Cancer cells, period?
Well, they can tell me a couple of things, and so I heavily rely on the pathologist when I get the results back from either a biopsy or a removed lesion, and they'll tell me, hey, doc, this is a hyperplastic polyp, for example. This is something that's benign and really has no chance of turning to cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Or it'll say adenoma. So this is a precancerous polyp, which means based on what I saw as far as the size and the number of polyps, that would mean that I need to adjust my interval for the patient having a repeat exam accordingly. And if it's cancer, for me, that would mean, well, we have to do a couple of things. Number one, we may have to do some blood testing. We will need to do some scans just to make sure that the cancer is either isolated in the colon or has it extended elsewhere. And we need to do a multidisciplinary approach where we engage our surgeon and or our oncologist or cancer doctor colleagues.
Let's go over again some of those symptoms that people might ignore or put off because they're not really bothering them that much, but that you would be concerned about.
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, I'll tell you, in my practice, I have unfortunately seen too many young people who have experienced symptoms for some time, ignored them, or even worse, not ignore them and talk to a provider about them, but the provider has ignored them for some time. Those symptoms can include things like rectal bleeding, so seeing blood in the stool. And, you know, a lot of times this can be mistaken for just hemorrhoids, but certainly you should seek professional attention in regards to that to do an examination. Other things could be chronic abdominal pain. And sometimes people may say, oh, this just cramps, or it's this or it's that.
Mm-hmm.
But it may require further attention. attention. And lastly, you know, one of the other things that sometimes people ignore are things like anemia, because particularly for women who are menstruating, they might just associate that iron deficiency or lack of iron that's causing an anemia or low blood count to that. But certainly if it's not responding to iron or it's not something that is responding that you would that your doctor is seeing change in, it needs further investigation.
And anemia in older women, is that maybe more of a warning?
Yeah, older women and men.
Okay.
And especially, you know, that's, I'm glad you brought that up because it's an important point to stress, because sometimes people think that colorectal cancer is gender specific. It is not. It is no respecter of gender. And so both women and men are impacted by colorectal cancer and can develop anemia from it.
Well, Dr. Daryl Gray, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
It was truly a pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Daryl Gray is gastroenterologist and deputy director of the Center for Cancer Health Equity at Ohio State University James Cancer Hospital. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thanks so much for joining us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.